Coming to you from New York City, it's the Friars Club Podcast. Established in 1904, the Friars Club is the birthplace of the celebrity roast and has counted the likes of Frank Sinatra, Jimmy Fallon, Billy Crystal, Barbara Streisand, and Johnny Carson among its members. So come on in for a drink and some laughs with your host, Joe Sibilia.
Hello and welcome to the Friars Club Podcast. This is your host, Joe Sibilia, and joining me today is somebody I am a tremendous fan of and whose father I'm a tremendous fan of. His name is Noel Blanc. He is a voice actor, a producer, and if you don't know, he is the son of a beloved member of the Friars Club, Mel Blanc, the man of a thousand voices, who created the voices for so many of the great cartoon characters, including Bugs Bunny, Porky Pig, Daffy Duck, Woody Woodpecker, Barney Rubble of the Flintstones, and so many others. And it's such a delight to be talking with Noel Blanc. Noel, how are you? It's great to talk to you.
What's up, Joe?
You're definitely as your father's dad, son.
As my dad used to say, oh, yeah. He was an amazing man, that's for sure. I'm glad you called about him.
Well, you know, Noel, I told you this when we first talked a while back. I'm 27, and since I'm about 8 or 9, I have been obsessed with your father and his body of work, and I just an idol to me and the reason why I wanted to get into the entertainment industry. So to talk to you is truly nothing short of astonishing to me. So thank you for making the time. I really appreciate
it. Yes, I wish you could have talked to him, but you weren't born yet.
Yeah. Well, listen, to talk to you is just as great. But let me start with this. So now your father, I found out, was involved with the Friars Club actually because of an auction that took place a few years ago. And one of the items that was up for bids was his membership card for the Friars Club. Do you know how he first became involved with the Friars? And I understand there was a big event that they held for him back in 1961. What was the story
behind 61,
that?
When he had just, he had come home from the hospital after 3 months with a terrible collision on Dead Man's Curve just above UCLA. And he was hit by a 98 Oldsmobile. He was in a little aluminum car in Aston Martin, and it just crumpled. And he broke basically every bone in his body. He was out and unconscious for about 12 to 14 days. And incidentally, the story goes with that because the doctor kept coming in to the room where he was in ICU and kept looking up at the television screen like they have in all the ICUs. They got a TV screen up there playing the latest, whatever it might be. And, of course, Warner Brothers cartoons were on, 24 hours a day back there in 61. And he'd keep that on a channel where a lot of the cartoons would appear. And one day he got an idea and went up to my dad, who was unconscious now for about 12, 14 days, and says, "Bugs Bunny, can you hear me? Bugs Bunny." And I was there when my dad turned to the left and said,
"What's up, Doc? Where am I?"
That's incredible.
And then he said, "Porky Pig, can you hear me?" He said,
I can hear you.
He went through, about 5 or 6 characters. So that's how we say Bugs Bunny saved his life, because he came out of the coma and he didn't know where he was. He says, "Where am I?" And I said, "Reach down, you'll feel you got a body cast right up almost to your neck." And he was in a full body cast with his legs out straight with a pole in between him. And he says, "Weren't we supposed to go to Hawaii with Mom?" I says, "Yeah, but you're in the hospital and I had a terrific collision on Dead Man's Curve in West Los Angeles." Luckily, the curve was only about a mile from UCLA Hospital, which saved his life because it lost a lot of blood and broke darn near every bone in his body.
It's a miracle that he even survived that accident, and by the grace of God, he did. And then the Friars held an event in his honor, correct? And this was
right.
61?
Yes, and the whole Jack Benny cast was there. I remember Alan Mowbray, the actor who was number one on the Screen Actors Guild card, the number one card, he was there.
Oh, wow.
To talk about Mel and the Screen Actors Guild and how he had more credits than any person alive. So it was really a great luncheon there at the Friars Club in that wonderful room upstairs. And, the Friars Club was part of his life.
Well, it's interesting because your father, and people may not even realize this, but he worked with and was friends with so many of the Friars. And you mentioned Jack Benny, who was a Friar for decades. And he worked very closely with your father because your father was on all of his radio and television programs from, I guess it would have been the 1940s onward. How did your father first hook up with Jack Benny?
Well, the lucky thing about it, my dad had been trying to get into cartoons for so many years. And when he finally did and knocked on the door one day, and a fellow by the name of Trey Brown, who was the sound effects man, said, "Gee, where have you been?" He says, "I've been knocking on the door every 2 weeks for the last 2 years, and the fellow wouldn't let me in." He says, "Well, come on upstairs." So they went upstairs. Mel had a little audition that he did. It was about a four-minute thing. The guys went nuts upstairs. It was during a Christmas party, actually, about this time of year.
Right.
And they said, "Are you free next Tuesday?" And my dad, of course, wasn't working. And he says, "Of course." So he did the growl of a bear for the first cartoon, and then, of course, took over with Porky Pig, Daffy Duck, Tweety, Sylvester, you name them, Tasmanian Devil, Foghorn Leghorn, Pepe Le Pew, Roadrunner.
From his work in the cartoons, he had that exclusive screen credit deal.
That, yes, because he wanted a raise after 3 years, and they were giving him $45 a week, which wasn't a lot then. And isn't, of course, not a lot now. And he wanted to, at least to raise him to $65 a week. And they said, "Well," Leon said, "well, I'll tell you what, we'll give you screen credit instead." And that was the thing that got my dad all the radio shows. Because whenever they went to the movies, and remember, 50 million people a week were going to the movies, and most of the cartoons were Warner Brothers cartoons. There were some Popeye and things like that, but most of them were Warner's, and it was the only studio that gave voice credit to the cartoon people. So all the radio people looked at his, you know, at these Looney Tunes on a consistent basis, and, gee, that was terrific because they wrote down his name and called him in, and, of course, he auditioned and got the voice on the show. At one time, he was doing 18 radio shows a week.
Which is an astonishing feat, but luckily for him, in those days, all of the radio broadcast studios that emanated from Hollywood that did the network radio shows, they were all within a couple of blocks of each other, right?
That's right. NBC, ABC, and CBS were all walking distance, or my dad used to say running distance. He stayed in shape. He couldn't eat lunch because he was going from one show to the next rehearsal to the next show. So he stayed in shape during that time. And it was wonderful that all those studios were located so closely.
Now, isn't it true that when he would go from studio to studio, if he was going to, for example, go from ABC to NBC or NBC to CBS, he would have to make sure and be mindful of the pack of cigarettes that he carried in his pocket?
Oh, that was really funny. Do you realize, well, do you know that the sponsors really owned all the shows? It's the Lucky Strike presents the Jack Benny Show. The sponsor was always mentioned first. Old Gold presents I Love Lucy. Whatever it might be, the sponsor came first. So they had a man in the studio that all the performers would have to actually stand up next to when he came up to you, and he'd feel around in your pocket up above breast pocket where everybody was carrying their cigarettes. So he'd look at it and grab the cigarettes, take them out of your pocket. He'd look at it, and if you were on the Lucky Strike show and smoking Camels, he would crush them right in front of you like that with his hand. And so he had to change. He had something like five different cigarette brands. I think it was Pall Mall, Old Gold, Chesterfield, like that, in his glove compartment. And when he would get ready to leave and go to the next studio, he'd put the four or five packs of cigarettes that were sponsors for the following shows in his pocket, in his pants pockets, and go to the shows. And then as they came to the show where he was smoking the Old Golds, he'd pull those out and put them in his pocket. It's a true story with everybody that was doing radio at that time, especially the cigarette advertising was huge.
Gone are the days of the great network radio shows, but fortunately they all live on online, and you can listen to your father's work at any time. So much of it is available on the internet now, which is...
Evan Costello's show and Dagwood and Blondie and Judy Canova and Al Pierce and Jack Benny, George Burns, Gracie Allen. It keeps on going, Abbott and Costello, you name it. he was on their shows. So they're all available now, yeah, online.
So now back to Jack Benny for a second. He and your father, I know, were pretty close friends. Is it true that when your father was in that terrible car accident that Jack Benny went to visit him every day that he was in the hospital?
I'd pick him up in my car. The hospital was very close to his office in Beverly Hills, you know, 2 miles or less, and I would drive him over, and he would visit my dad. Oh, yes. They were very close friends. Jack Benny spent summers up at Big Bear, a few summers with his daughter, Joni, and her friend Hannah when they were kids. Joni was 12, and Hannah was 12. They'd come up, and Jack would come up. Mary wouldn't come up. She wasn't a mountain fan.
Right, right.
He'd come up, and we'd have the greatest times up there. And then, of course, he would take George Burns up in the winter with my dad. And we had just fabulous times up at Big Bear Lake in the same cabin with the same furniture that we still have right now.
That's astounding that all these years later, it's still in the family.
Yeah, 77 years later, my mom and I actually found the lot, which was the most beautiful lot you'd ever seen, and it was in a cove that was totally calm, but you could see the entire lake from the cove. And my dad came down, caught his limit of fish, and says, I gotta find out who owns this piece of property. He did. The guy wanted $600. He said, that doesn't sound like too much to me, and bought it. And we're still there, and literally the cove is in deep water looking down on most of the lake. And we're about 15 yards from the water. And it's been there for 77 years with the same furniture, the same built out of red log cabin wood, you know, the local logs that
right.
were there. And, we have the same furniture that Jack and George Burns, Lucille Ball, they all sat in. And in later years, Vincent Price and Kirk Douglas and Jack Palance all came up. So, yeah, we've got a lot of history right there in Big Bear. My dad was honorary mayor there for 32 years.
And wrote that great song about Big Bear Lake.
Those moonlight nights, so calm and serene, the quiet seems enduring. But comes the dawn, the silence is gone.
They're out of their mooring. Big Bear Lake with the motorboats a-puttin'. Big Bear Lake, they're a-buzzin' and a-buttin'. Big Bear Lake with the motorboats a-puttin'. Puttin' all day.
Rest, rest, relax, relax. Quiet, quiet, quiet!
I hear it every day many times because the tour boats come by. And Mel used to get on his megaphone. It was a regular, like a Rudy Valley megaphone. I don't know if you know what that means. A cheerleader
Oh,
megaphone.
Sure. Yeah, yeah. A plastic thing or something. Yeah.
Yeah. But I have an electric one. And he used to do his characters for the one tour boat, which came by about 3 or 4 times a day. Now we've got about 4 or 5 tour boats that come by 3 or 4 times a day. And I'm out there on the porch roughly every hour or less out there doing the same thing he did because they had heard about that he had done that.
So now I understand that your mom and dad used to host ping pong nights at your house when you were growing up, and they'd make soda fountain beverages. And who were some of the people who would come over? Because as I understand it, it was like a who's who of people who were involved at one point or another with the Friars Club.
Oh, yes. Sheldon Leonard, Hans Conried, of course, George Burns and Jack. Milton Berle. All the people I can't really remember, and their wives, of course. And my folks never really served alcohol to anybody because they didn't want them to come all the way out to play at El Rey, where we lived at that time, and where there was only about 75 people living in that area and play at El Rey. That's not Marina del Rey what it is now, but play at El Rey, the little teeny village on the coast there.
It's an airport now, right? Didn't they turn
that
into an airstrip or
something?
We had
to move out of there because the airport bought the land that we were on overlooking the ocean. Because their planes were flying at an altitude of about 300 to 500 feet over our heads. So we had to move out, and then eventually they bought the entire land below them at that time, which the airport owns now all the way to the beach, because they extended the runways on the airport.
So when you were growing up, and obviously you're surrounded around so many of these famous faces from film and television and radio, although on radio it's not really a famous face, I suppose, a famous voice, but I digress. When you were growing up, what do you remember about going to work with your father, whether he was recording a cartoon at Warner Brothers or doing one of the numerous radio shows that he was on?
Oh, something I remember. See, I wasn't able to sit in the audience because I was too young. You needed to be at least 12 years old to sit in the audience, because they figure if you were younger than that, you know, wet your pants or start screaming. I don't know why they didn't let us sit in the audience. So we sat in the sponsor's booth, and during the show, where, of course, the sponsors conducted their meetings and decided if the rehearsal was right. And again, Lucky Strike ran the show, and before that, Jell-O did. But the things that I remember wasn't the Jack Benny show as much as George Burns and Gracie Allen. Gracie Allen, I was about 5 years, 6 years old, and she really, really liked me an awful lot. And she used to let me sit on her lap while they were doing the rehearsals. And that's the thing that I really remember kind of exciting at that time, was to sit there with George Burns and the rest of the cast, my dad doing the postman.
I was going to ask you about George and Gracie. You beat me to it. He was the happy postman.
The happy postman, and he'd cry. And he'd keep smiling, you know. yes. And my dad, talk about his talent. His talent was so amazing that I have never seen anything like it. There's a lot of people that imitate, but he never imitated. He always created his voices. And not only did he create his voices, he also wouldn't do imitations of other people. So each voice that he created was something that he came up with. And the Happy Postman was one of those, of course. But it's really interesting to me that he did so many voices, and people don't realize how many dialects he could do. He was the best dialectician I'd ever heard. He could do, you know, six regions of the United States. He could do separate Canadian from Australian, from New Zealand, from England, from Ireland, of course, and Scotland. Distinct dialects. All he had to do was hear it once, and he could do the dialect. So he could do so many things on so many shows.
Well, I saw him demonstrate that when he was on the Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. Now, let me ask you a question while I mentioned him. Was he friendly with Johnny Carson off camera? Because I know he did the Tonight Show a few times, and Johnny, of course, loved Jack Benny.
Johnny Carson he liked the same as my dad, didn't like cocktail parties at all. So they got to know each other by sitting in the corner together at a table whenever these cocktail parties would arise, and just talking, because neither one of them liked walking around with a drink in their hand.
Oh, that's interesting. But your father always struck me as a pretty social guy, so that surprises me a little bit.
Yeah, he was a one-drink guy. That's it.
I want to talk a little bit about some of his animation work, obviously, because that's how so many of us were first introduced to him. I don't know how many people recognize this name, but you'd see it in front of all the cartoons. Leon Schlesinger, who was the original proprietor of the animation studio and the producer of the Warner's cartoons before Warner Brothers bought him out in, I think, 1944.
Uh-huh.
Did you ever get to meet Schlesinger at
sure.
all?
Sure.
Now,
yeah.
What was he like? I hear he was quite
the character. Businessman. He just let the guys do what they wanted. And there were so many brilliant people, whether it's Fritz Feeling, Chuck Jones, Bob McKimson, all those great directors. He just let them go, basically. They just could do whatever they wanted. The stories were very good because they appealed to adults more than they did to kids at that time. So the cartoons, the early Warner's cartoons over the years appealed to adults because it had adult humor. But they were funny because they were kids and they did kids' things. So Leon Schlesinger just let him go at that. And that's all I remember of Leon Schlesinger just saying, do what you want.
And he always threw those great Christmas parties at the Wilshire Bowl every year.
Yeah.
And where all of the animators and the ink and paint artists and all those people. I was friendly for a little while with a woman who sadly has passed away. Her name was Martha Siegel, and she worked at the studio for years, and she used to rave about your father, but just about working there at that time. It was just filled with so many wonderful characters. A lot of the names you just mentioned, Chuck Jones, who, of course, brought the world the Grinch many years later, and Frizz Freeling, who went on to create the Pink Panther. It was it was quite a time to be in that world. Were there certain animation producers that your father preferred to work for over others? I know, obviously, he had that longstanding relationship with Warner's, but he worked for Hanna-Barbera for years doing things like the Flintstones.
After the accident, he did the first 65, rather, after the first six were made, he had the accident, and he did the rest of those. Dawes Butler did a few, but they wanted Mel to come back, and he was on a body cast. And we did the rest of them by building a studio in his house in Pacific Palisades in my old little bedroom area, which was kind of like a little den area. And Joe Barbera and I'd sit back there, record the show, and we ran the cables underneath to his bed, which he was still in a body cast with the bar between his legs, and he could barely get into maybe a 20-degree incline with the microphone suspended over his head. And the Flintstone cast would gather around the bed, and we did about 70 shows that way.
Oh, there's some great photos. You can find them online of him. And like you just said, he's surrounded by, it's Alan Reed, who was Fred Flintstone, and Bea Benaderet, who was Betty Rubble, and Gene Vanderpile, Wilma Flintstone. It's amazing that he was able to do that. And to watch the shows, I mean, can you tell when you watch them, like when you hear a show that he recorded in that manner, can you picture it like, oh yeah, this is him doing it in the body cast? Can you tell from the performance or from the energy?
No, you couldn't tell from the performance.
Because I couldn't. That's why I ask. I can't tell.
Of course. And then they'd bring the big studio vans out for his cartoons. They would rather record those, you know, they on film, on magnetape, 90 feet a minute, or 90 feet a second. 24 frames a second. 90 feet per minute, yeah.
Don't ask me, I don't know math.
Yeah, 90 feet per minute. They'd record it in the vans because they had these giant recording machines, and they'd run the cables in the house and then to the bedroom for him to solo, Bugs, Porky, Daffy, Tweety, so that's all of those. So he did all the cartoons for almost a full year in a supine position on the bed.
That's incredible. I don't know how anybody could do it except your father. That takes an incredible talent to be able to get
Plus doing all the commercials that we had started at Mel Blanc Associates, which is Blanc Communications now. And we had started that in 61, about 2 weeks before the accident. So when we started to get clients for comedy radio commercials, he recorded all of those also. He was recording every day. And I was in that little studio next, about 60 feet from the bedroom in a little closet with my earphones on recording him.
Well, I was going to ask you about that. How did you end up going into business with your father in that end of the industry? What was the impetus of that?
We loved to do comedy cartoons. He was doing, with an advertising agency in San Francisco called Capel, Pear, and Reed, he was doing 10-second spots there that were just sensational, and everybody remembers in San Francisco, that's old enough, farms in Berkeley Farm, commercials like that. Every month he'd run up and do 10-second commercials for a number of clients. And so he says, why don't we, hire that writer and bring him down here and do our own. And that's what we did.
So how did you discover that you had a propensity to do a lot of the voices that your father created? Or was it something that was more pointed out to you by your father?
He said that I could do his voices. I really was never a voice man, nor still am. I did when he was in the accident and they wanted some recordings done at the studio. I never let anybody know that I did him. But I did a number of the cartoons out in there, Big Stage 14. Once the accident, he could record out of the house, of course. Then he did it himself on his back. So I knew I could do some of the voices, that I could imitate them. And no one could do the personality that he can do and the range that he could do. And he had perfect pitch. I could sit on the piano. He could tell you what notes I was sitting on.
So he had amazing.
He had a perfect pitch. He could sing the lead like Bugs Bunny in a song and harmonize with maybe six or seven other characters without any additional music for the harmony. Because he had perfect pitch, he could harmonize each one.
That is astounding.
Nobody had all these qualities that he did as far as ear and vocal range.
And the great timing of a master comedian.
That's it. Yeah, he was one of a kind. I really think some of the great voices around now who can really imitate, nobody like Jeff Bergman, he is the best. He can sound like anybody. And he can sound like my dad talking. So when he does my dad doing Sylvester, it scares me because it sounds like Sylvester.
Yeah, and Jeff Bergman is a really great talent. He is a marvelous impressionist. He
is the most amazing talent outside of my dad that I've ever met. And I met him 34 years ago when he was trying to do the same things that I was. We were doing the parts. And he came to me and he says, gee, we're working for the same thing. And I said, yeah. I says, you're terrific. And then he says, well, I can talk like your dad. That's how I do it. I can copy anything. And then he started talking like my dad, and my God, it's scary. It really is scary.
I could only imagine.
He's done every voice you can imagine. He can sound like every performer. And it's not like a Rich Little or anything that has to do with visual performance. He just has the capacity to hear a voice and do it. And so he is amazing. Now, will Warner Brothers let him do everything? Well, he's doing Fred Flintstone and Barney Rubble right now for Warner Hanna-Barbera Warner Brothers. He's doing both of those voices, and which is interesting because one is a totally different voice than the other. But he can imitate any voice. It doesn't do dialects, but any voice he can imitate. So when an actor needs, Morgan Freeman needed someone to do his voice because he had laryngitis, so they called Jeff Bergman. He talks... He listens to Morgan and does Morgan, and you can't tell the difference.
That's an amazing talent.
Yeah, he's the most amazing talent I've ever seen.
You know, your father really was very generous to so many of his peers in the voiceover world. I know he employed a lot of them, and you employed a lot of them with your company doing the radio spots. I wanted to bring up a few and see some of the people your father has worked with over the years or you may have worked with at the recording. I want to see if maybe you had memories of them or just any thoughts on them if I ran through a few names. And let me start with somebody who was a larger-than-life personality, and that would be Paul Frees, who was, of course, Boris Badenov and did many of the Rankin and Bass holiday specials and on and on and on, of course.
Paul Frees was an amazing creator of voices. There's no doubt about it. And the interesting thing about it, Paul Frees, not a lot of people liked Paul, but he was such a talent. Of course, they'd hire him, but he was a strange guy. He had his own studio up near San Francisco.
He lived up in Tiburon, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, had a great studio up there, and he was an amazing talent because he created a lot of voices, like Dawes Butler. And Dawes Butler was the sweetest guy in the world. But Paul Frees was really tough and a great talent, but he never got the recognition that he needed. So, you know, he'd go out to dinner and dress up like a Russian count, with a cane and a monocle. I mean, amazing.
He had that mustache going there for a while.
He had to have some attention. He never got it. So I guess he was always jealous of Mel. And, of course, he was making a heck of a lot more money than my dad was because he did a lot more commercials, television commercials at that time.
That wouldn't have ever occurred to me that he would have earned more than your father.
Gosh.
Of course, he was the Pillsbury Doughboy. He got a lot of money doing that.
Phew. I'm Poppin' Fresh, the Pillsbury Doughboy. Nothing says lovin' like something from the oven, and Pillsbury says it best.
Hey, Reese Witherspoon made more money by doing one film voiceover than my dad made in his whole career times five. She got millions of dollars for doing one voice. Now they paid the big stars millions and millions of dollars to do a voice. My dad was getting, again, $65 a week, and that was that.
That's astounding. Did you ever get to know Paul Winchell at all? I know he and your father did some shows together.
Paul Winchell was a brilliant, brilliant inventor also. Invented the first mechanical heart.
Right.
Yeah.
And the disposable razor.
And a terrific talent and a nice fellow. We only worked with him a couple of times. We enjoyed his show. He had the Paul Winchell, Jerry Mahoney show on television at about 6:30 at night during the early 50s, late 40s.
And then, of course, you mentioned this name before. This guy was a real character, Hans Conried. who was wonderful Captain Hook.
One of Mel's closest friends. A terrific, funny guy. And, of course, he just had the one voice, which was kind of like a strange voice that he would do. He could do a couple of dialects. But he was a great actor, a great radio actor, and a really wonderful spent a lot of time up at Big Bear with us, like Sheldon Leonard did, who became one of the big television producers with Danny Thomas.
Of course. And he plays the bartender in It's a Wonderful Life. Watch out for him. Yes, he's the bartender in It's a Wonderful Life, and he threatens to throw him out of the bar when he goes.
Sheldon is, huh?
Yep.
Oh, my gosh.
Back when he was still acting. And I think he did Guys and Dolls with Sinatra. He was he was an interesting guy, Sheldon Leonard. Now let me test you, Noel. I don't know if you'll even remember this person. I'll be amazed if you do. But somebody I know who I used to work with, this was a very close family friend of theirs, because he would MC the Allentown Fair every year. He worked with Ted Fiorito as a bass player and later got into doing some voiceovers. And I had heard he worked with you and your dad, Candy Candido. Do you remember him at all?
Oh, Candy Candido had an amazing set of vocal cords. Do you know that?
Yes, he had that trick voice where he could do a real high voice or do the real low voice, which he did on the Jimmy Durante show.
Unfortunately, Candy, that's what he did, a high voice and a low voice. He never got around to doing much more than that, but he was wonderful. Candy was the sweetest guy with an amazing set of vocal cords, but never really created any great characters.
Your father worked very closely with Alan Reed, of course, on the Flintstones.
Again, a neat guy. And Alan Reed Jr., his son, is a wonderful actor and a nice fellow also. Alan Reed, he had so much voice problem because he'd have to take honey and hot water every night during the show to sustain that gravelly voice. But it was terrific, and his timing was great. And Alan did a lot of television and movies. Viva Zapata, he was one of the leads in Viva Zapata, in fact.
Your father was active all the way up to the end. I mean, he, of course, did his voice in Who Framed Roger Rabbit.
We never talk about Capitol Records and my dad.
Yeah, let's talk about that a little bit. Yes, your father did...
You know something? He sold more Capitol Records between 1947 and 1951 than Nat King Cole or Frank Sinatra.
And he worked with all the same Billy May and all of those arrangers.
Billy May was the greatest arranger that I had ever met, and that probably has lived in the last 70 years. But Billy May did backgrounds for everybody and wrote, arranged for just about everybody without mentioning his name or their names. He was all over the place, especially at Capitol Records.
Oh, so what was it like when your father would go and record at Capitol Records on the day, and what was the process back then? Especially because I know your father, there were some voices he would do, and he would do the recordings, Daffy Duck and Tweety Pie and certain characters.
He did a couple hundred records, but his records alone sold 14 million.
That's astounding. There's that great film of him. It's like a 30-minute advertising film of him pitching Capitol Records to different people. The guy walks in the store.
Yes, with Billy May.
That was Billy May, right? Who played the guy?
Billy May, the great big guy.
Yeah. That's incredible.
He was drinking too much, so he started eating a vanilla ice cream and got that weight, but he was still the greatest arranger composer you'll ever want to meet, and the neatest guy.
My goodness. But
I met and lived through all these guys, and it was really a treat. And my dad was such a great dad, and my mom a great mom. We had a great family.
Well, your father and mother, when they were young, they did a radio show together called, Cobwebs and Nuts?
Cobwebs and Nuts. And my dad did all the male voices, and my mom did all the female voices.
Was that how they met?
They wrote the show 5 days a week, an hour show, for years, up in Portland. And for $15 total a week between the two of them.
That's
my dad said, well, instead of starving in Portland, we might as well move down to Los Angeles. Maybe we'll do better than starving down there. They moved in with my mom's folks, and that's when he got the job at Warner Brothers after 2 years.
So your father, how was he able to maintain that instrument that he had all the way up to the end of his life? I mean, he could still do all of the voices that he had always been doing.
All of them, and all of them were just as great. And he started smoking at 9 years old. And then I said, Dad, you got to quit smoking. It's not good for the heart. he started having a little heart trouble at that time. So he almost refused to quit smoking. And I had the doctor tell him he must go on oxygen when he's at home. So, Dad, I said, you're on oxygen now. You're going to blow up the house, and you don't want to do that. So we quit smoking then.
It worked. That was
it worked.
I guess you probably bought him a few more years.
Oh, yeah, maybe 10. But he didn't die from a heart problem. He fell out of bed. He had a cold. And we had done a television together for Oldsmobile, the only television commercial we ever did together, both live action and animation. It's Not Your Father's Oldsmobile. And that was 1989 and or 88. And he had the cold. He had a bit of a flu and then the cold. And yet he was able to do the commercial. We were doing the commercial all day long. And then I says, Dad, you better get over to the doctor and get a shot. And the doctor calls me up and said, yeah, I could keep him in bed overnight or I can give him a shot and he'll feel better. I says, Dad, what do you want to do? So he said, I'll stay overnight, and they cleaned my lungs out. They forgot to put the bed rails up. And what happened is he fell out of bed, and you know how high a hospital bed is.
Right, right.
He broke his femur, got fat emboli into the brain because of the open big bone, and passed away within 2 weeks.
That's
not
terrible.
Many people know that. They think he died of a heart attack or something. That's not true.
He could have went on for another 15 years. Who knows?
You never know.
How would you like your father to be remembered after all these years? I wanted to pay a little tribute to him on the Friars Club podcast because, again, like I said, you know, obviously the Friars thought enough of him to honor him after his car accident, and beyond that, just worked with so many of these legends, and your father being a legend himself. How would you like him to be remembered after all these years?
Well, as a great father and the most amazing voice man of the last 100 years.
I think that's doable. It's amazing the staying power that animation gives you, the immortality that it gives you, because,
that's,
I mean, this...
Age. Hey, I realize that when I go out on the boat, when I say, when I'm out on the deck, I'm talking to about 3,000 to 4,000 people a week. And the people just crowd for Bugs, Porky, Daffy, Tweety, Sylvester, that's all they want to hear. They're like they're brand new. And if I walked out there and said, you know, I'm... Kirk Douglas, or I mean, even Michael Douglas, they wouldn't know who I'm talking about. They only know the last 4 years. Michael Douglas is an old man by now. And even though he was such a major star, Kirk even bigger, no one would know that. They wouldn't know Burt Lancaster, Gregory Peck, you know, Henry Fonda. Those names are all gone. They would know Elvis Presley. I might know Marilyn Monroe. And some will know James Dean, but that's it. But they sure know Bugs and the rest of the cartoon gang like they were brand new. Whenever my dad used to travel, he spoke at about over 150 colleges in his later years.
Right.
And the thing that he liked the most is going to the kids' hospitals. Not only Shrine Burn Center's hospital, but the hospitals at that time that had the iron lungs because they hadn't had a cure for polio at that time. And he would visit all the kids in the iron lungs. He would, when he got into a town to do the voices and a speech at the whatever college or university he went to, he would before go and visit the children's hospitals. Yeah, he was a very giving man.
That's what I had heard. And well, let me ask you, Noel, what are you up to these days? I know you said you're still active with your company. What have you been up to in the recent years, if I might ask?
Well, I had I used to travel different areas just for fun. I learned how to fly a helicopter. And I got a helicopter in 1983. I went for a ride in one and said, geez, I got to learn how to fly one of these. I didn't realize flying a helicopter is 9 times harder than flying an airplane.
Well, could I ask you about something? If you don't want to talk about this, I totally respect that, and it's perfectly fine. But I read something that you almost had a similar experience to your father flying.
Yes, we broke the same number of bones, and they gave us all 1,000 to 1 chance. And it was exactly 30 years after my dad, and I'm 30 years younger than my dad. It was, you could have taken the x-rays, and the x-rays that were taken after his car crash would probably match what happened to my x-rays taken when a plane hit me And I was with Kirk Douglas at that time. We were flying back from Santa Paula. We had just picked some oranges up there, and Kirk and I were flying back from Santa Paula. And yes, we did get hit by an aircraft. They both died immediately, and we were lucky. We fell to the ground 60 feet. I mean, the fall doesn't hurt you. It's the asphalt at the end. It does.
But it's a miracle you survived.
Yeah, and Kirk lived to 103, so who knows, you know.
Oh, my goodness. That's incredible, too. Noel, you have I keep saying it, but you've lived an incredible life. You're a very fortunate man. I can certainly say that.
Thank you. I feel that way. I really do. I've got a wonderful wife. We've known each other, 41 years now.
Wow.
And she was a writer for us. And, yeah, we have great times where we are right here. I'm just looking out on the beach in Santa Monica.
Well, Noel, why don't you take us out here at the end here of the Friars Club podcast today, the way your father would have.
Okay. Stay tuned, and as Porky Pig would say,
that's all, folks.
Noel, thank you so much for your time. I hope you enjoyed this as much as I did. It really has been an honor to talk to you.
I absolutely did, Joseph. Really did. I enjoyed it. Call me anytime.
Thanks for listening to the Friars Club podcast. Please be sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode. For more information on the Friars Club, please visit friarsclub.com. We hope to see you there.